This is the time set for case number 51674, Damodar Motel versus Mann. We have Mr. Eisenberg for the appellants, Mr. Walsh for the respondent, and we're ready to proceed. Mr. Eisenberg, did you want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to attempt to reserve approximately 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. For the record, I'm Robert Eisenberg, representing the appellants. As you know, this is a case involving an arbitration decision and judicial review of the arbitration decision. It took a rather unusual winding road to get here. The case was originally filed in the district court, then it was referred to the arbitration in California, went back to the district court, then was referred back to the arbitrator for clarification of an ambiguous decision, went back to the district court, came up here, was remanded back to the district court for another judgment, and then came back up here again. And even in the arbitration proceedings, it went through a kind of a tortured path. There was the original decision by the arbitrator, then a final decision by the arbitrator, then a modified final decision by the arbitrator, and then an amended modified final decision by the arbitrator. So here we are. And I do want to mention the standard of review. The answering brief, which consists of about a page and a half of legal argument, focuses on the standard of review. And we suggest that although the standard of review in a judicial review of an arbitration decision is a difficult standard for the appellant to meet, that it's not a rubber stamp situation, that judicial review of an arbitrator's decision does have some legitimate role, and that the arbitrator's decision has to comply with the law. The most important question, or not the most important, but certainly one of the most important questions, whether the arbitrator applied the correct law by applying California law and not Nevada law. We submit that that is a critical, important decision in any arbitration. And that the arbitrator manifestly abused her discretion by applying California law. One of the big issues in the arbitration was whether the real estate commission should have been paid to Joga Mann's company, ABS, arising out of the purchase and sale of the motel, which is located here in Carson City. That real estate commission could only have arisen out of the purchase agreement, not the LLC, because it was the purchase agreement that gave the source of money to pay the commission, and Mr. Mann's company, the ABS company, was not a party to the LLC agreement. The commission was paid solely as a result of the real estate transaction. And the purchase agreement stated, "This agreement shall be governed by and construed in accordance with the laws of the state of Nevada." And additionally, the purchase agreement had a provision dealing with commissions, and it said, "Any controversy arising out of the payment of a commission shall be decided by neutral arbitration as provided by the Nevada revised statutes." Well, the arbitrator here decided that California law should apply because of a provision not in the purchase agreement, but in a provision in the operating agreement for the LLC.
I guess, Mr. Eisenberg, my concern is this, is assuming we agreed with you on this point under that Rainbow Medical case, can we second guess the arbitrator on that issue, or is that something we're permitted to review on the applicable law for review for conducting the arbitration?
You are permitted, you and the district court were permitted, to review whether the arbitrator committed a manifest disregard of the law. And it's our position here that this was crystal clear, that a provision dealing with that says this agreement shall be governed by the laws of the state of Nevada in a Nevada transaction involving a Nevada motel and even a Nevada LLC, that the law was clear and that the arbitrator did manifestly disregard that. An arbitrator, can you imagine if an arbitrator could just ignore the law? or if the law is crystal clear based on contracts, just decide what the wrong law is. And that's why I said earlier, this is such an important issue, deciding which state's law applies. Clearly, I believe it's within the proper role of this court to make that determination.
Can I also ask you one other question? Ani, you've argued that your answering brief is inadequate and all. Could you tell me why it doesn't comply with the sufficiently with Nevada rules of appellate procedure?
Well, as we pointed out in our reply brief, the doctrine of a confession of error applies when a party doesn't file a brief at all, but it also applies in a situation where a party files an answering brief that does not address or does not adequately address issues raised in the opening brief. And we have suggested that the answering brief in this case, which really is only a page and a half of argument, is inadequate in that regard. It doesn't give the court an opportunity to consider what the arguments are. And I don't know if counsel is going to try to supplement it here today and put me in the position where I'm not able to respond adequately because he's raising arguments he didn't raise before. But certainly we believe that although he touched on some of the issues, some they didn't address at all. And the case law supports finding of a confession of error.
Okay, thank you.
I did want to mention in terms of the which law applies, assuming Nevada law applies, why does it make a difference in this case? Under Nevada law, we believe that Mr. Mann had a fiduciary or a special or confidential or fiduciary relationship, however you phrase that, with Mr. Takkar. And there were several reasons why he did have that fiduciary relationship. He was an investment advisor, and this court's decision has said that creates that special relationship. He also was Mr. Takkar's tax preparer, similar to an accountant, and this court has said that's gives rise to that special relationship. They were also partners. Technically, it wasn't a partnership, it was an LLC, but they were members in the LLC and had a fiduciary relationship with each other. But perhaps most important, he was also the real estate broker for this transaction, in which there were three buyers, Mr. Mann, Mr. Takkar, and Mr. Honda. And so Joga Mann was one of the purchasers. He's also acting as the real estate broker for the transaction, and he's a partner of Mr. Takkar separately. So under Nevada law, we believe that it's clear under the Perry versus Jordan case and the Health Plan in Nevada versus Rainbow case that he did have that fiduciary type relationship and had the duty of utmost good faith and to disclose under Nevada real estate requirements what the commission was. This real estate purchase and sale agreement mentioned that ABS was the broker for the buyers, but it never said that he would be able to get a commission, didn't say what percentage he would get, didn't say how much money he would get. He was a partner with these people. He was one of the buyers. And under Nevada law, his obligation to them was to make a full disclosure. We also believe that, in addition, that it was crystal clear that the damages were awarded to the wrong party here. When a company, a corporation or an LLC, if somebody within it is doing acts, paying bills improperly or taking too much compensation, which is what the arbitrator found here, that it's the company that has suffered those damages, not the other partners or the other members of it, and that the damages should have been awarded to the company. Now, you might say, well, what difference does it make? Because the arbitrator only awarded Mr. Mann 30%, which was his ownership interest. Well, if the money goes to the company, then the company can make the decision whether that money is going to be used to be distributed to the members or is it going to be used for other things, ongoing expenses of the company, capital improvements, whatever. The partners may or may not get a distribution of it, yet the arbitrator here arbitrarily determined that there in essence, determined that there would be a distribution of the money by awarding damages to the company. And the last thing I wanted to mention before I reserve time has to do with Jogaman's, the award of money that was given to him for preparation of taxes that he didn't do. The operating agreement said that he had the obligation to do tax work to prepare the taxes for the LLC. It imposed an obligation on him, but it didn't say that he was entitled to be compensated for it. One of the provisions of the LLC says that, except as specified in this agreement, no member is entitled to remuneration for acting in the company business. Now, the arbitrator applied that very provision against Mr. Takkar when the arbitrator decided that even though he performed management services at the motel, he was not entitled to compensation for it because the LLC operating agreement didn't say he was entitled to compensation. Well, when it applied to Mr. Mann, who said, wait, I was supposed to be able to perform tax services, the agreement required him to perform tax services but didn't say that he was entitled to be compensated for it. It was simply one of the things that each member of the LLC had a different obligation to do different things. Some were compensated, one weren't, some weren't, and this one wasn't. There's no provision that said he was entitled to compensation. So we believe the arbitrator applied the wrong law, the wrong state law, awarded damages to the wrong entities, improperly awarded the services for tax services, compensation for tax services.
And of course, at the risk of taking your time, perhaps our presiding justice will give you a moment based on my question. You also add that the award of attorney's fees in this case was unreasonable given the $70,000 recovery and $100,000 award. Is there anything that you wish to add to that argument?
Well, except the a couple of things. First, I did the math this morning. The award of attorney's fees was 140% of the award itself. That's quite a contingency. But I would also add that if the court accepts our view that any of these other items of damages need to be reduced, then we think it's clearly the award of attorney's fees needs to be reevaluated because of the factors involved in an award of attorney's fees. Taking into consideration the result that was achieved, and since the result would be less, then we believe the attorney's fees need to be reevaluated. Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, may it please the court. I'm James Walsh for the respondents. I think the justice appropriately raised the threshold issue of what's the standard of review in this matter, and it is, has raised the key issue that they address in their appeal is this issue of the application of law, and did the arbitrator manifestly disregard the law, and that's the standard. And if you look at sort of the test that this court has created to determine whether the arbitrator manifestly disregarded the law, they certainly do not apply to this case. I think in the first instance, I think we submit that really this is not a case of the wrong application of the law. The arbitrator did not make a finding on the commission issue based on the application of any law, although the arbitrator did twice in the decision, I think at pages 8 and 15, specifically find that it was the intent of the party and the provisions of the agreements that California law did apply to the resolution of all disputes arising from this transaction.
Why was that? Why did the arbitrator conclude it was California law and not Nevada law?
Well, a number of reasons. Number one, it was a transaction between California residents. All of these parties are California residents. The only nexus with the state of Nevada is that the investment happens to be located here.
The property is here. The agreement was entered into here. The parties continue to work at the property here. I think there's a bit more of a nexus than just the property?
I don't believe so. The operating agreement itself specifically provides for the application of California law. While the appellants want to say that's just procedural, that's not the finding that the arbitrator made, and that's not the specific language of the agreement. And I think it's paragraph 13 or section 13 of the agreement specifically provides that it's an operating agreement created for a Nevada LLC, but they made a choice of law to apply California law. And that was the intent of the parties, and that was found by the arbitrator, and there's nothing wrong with that choice of law. But the arbitrator's decision really did not hinge on an application of California law per se. If you read her decision, it's fairly specific as on the commission issue. And the history of this transaction is, the original offer and acceptance had language in it with regard to the application of Nevada law, but that specifically merged by the merged and was extinguished by the terms of the operating agreement, which provides that all this is the sole and surviving agreement by and between the parties, and that's going to apply California law. But the arbitrator, looking at the commission issue, specifically found in her findings at page 8 that Mr. Takkar. And this goes to the appellant's argument that, you know, it wasn't disclosed to him. He said he was offended and felt betrayed when he learned about the payment of the commission. And the arbitrator just this flat found him to be untruthful. On page 5, she says, Takkar claimed he had not read the contract. To the contrary, there was uncontroverted evidence that he had reviewed the contract of sale and the other documents for 2 hours. And initialed the signature appears at various places on the days in purchase agreement. The purchased documents disclose the man is the real estate agent. There is serious questions about the credibility of his testimonies from Ranjit to Takkar. She just flat didn't believe him that he didn't know about the commission. That's what she based her decision on. And even if you take that away and say, okay, it's based on the application of California law rather than her factual findings, they have to meet the test that the arbitrator somehow manifestly disregarded, number one, the laws that require her to exercise what she's going to do in a choice of law, and number two, that she completely disregarded Nevada law, which would have compelled a different result. And that's just not the status of the record, and it's just not what she did. And in the Bowman case, this court has set out a fairly specific and noted that the inquiry on a manifest disregard standard is very limited. And even if the arbitrator here made an erroneous decision, this court should not be, and has said, they will not review that. Manifest disregard of law is something beyond and different from mere error in law or failure on the part of the arbitrator to understand or apply the law. So even if she reached the wrong result, it should not be reviewed or overturned by this court, and we submit she did not.
I know she cited the Bowman case. You didn't cite the Health Plan Nevada versus Rainbow Medical. I was just curious why. Yeah.
No particular reason. I just like the language of the Bowman case, Your Honor. And I think that is the correct standard and still the correct standard. And this court, I mean, they want to re-argue the merits of the dispute, say that the arbitrator should have awarded different damages or damages to a different party for a particular reason because it didn't comply with the arbitrator's decision. And that, again, is not the test, and that's not subject to review. You know, the key is knowing that the law compelled a different result, simply ignore the law. And that's just not the case here.
Mr. Walsh, neither side wanted this reported, this arbitration proceeding, I gather?
You know, I wasn't there, and I do not know the answer to that.
Okay, well, I mean, it wasn't, I assume it wasn't, because we don't have a record on here. We don't have a transcript.
As far as I know, it was not. I've never seen a transcript. The only thing I think either counsel have ever seen, both of us came late to this case, and the only thing we have seen are I think the majority of the underlying motions and pleadings.
Okay, and the pleadings and then the arbitrator's decision and all that.
That's correct.
Okay.
And to give you some, I guess, some factual history associated with this, as it's been noted, the initial purchase was in 1999, and in 2004, the lawsuits and the arbitrations commenced. The initial arbitrator's decision is in November of 2006. And is substantially unmodified since that time. Her findings remain the same. There were some issues about computation of interest and some issues to get the decision structured properly so it could be reviewed by this court. But the initial decision as entered in November of 2006, where the arbitrator made her initial findings of the misapplication of the proceeds from the investment and the misapplications of the profits from the investments and the wrongful payment of attorney's fees, that those findings remain unchanged since 2006. And so here we are essentially, 6 years after the initial arbitration and demands, the 30% owners of this investment have yet to see a dime from their investment, while the Takars have continued to take salaries and wrongfully, as the arbitrator found. And kind of getting off track here a little bit, the court had made an inquiry, and the counsel had responded with regard to the adequacy or reasonableness of the attorney's fees. They are substantial in this case, and they're substantial because of the procedural hoops, basically, that the mans have been forced to jump through with regard to the arbitrations and going back and forth. But the arbitrator made some specific findings as to the reasonableness of those attorney's fees. And I think the reasonableness, given her specific findings of the lack of veracity of Takar. And I think those fees, I don't think there's anything in the record that would allow the court to address the reasonableness of those fees. There's no arbitrary or capricious nature to them that's even argued. There's no manifest disregard of the law that's been pointed to or argued with regard to the application of those fees. And I would submit that they, you know, I think the only way this court could address them is if it somehow found that the arbitrator's award was improper and the award of damages were improper, and then I think it would be appropriate to then, you know, have some tweaking of the fees or removal of the fees.
Let me ask you this. In the reply brief, the appellant's arguing that the answering brief was inadequate as far as the page and a half of the legal argument. What's your position on that?
Well, Your Honor, I think we touched on all the factual issues that are raised in our brief. And I think everything flows back to this concept of they have to show some manifest disregard for the law, and they just have flat not done that.
So you're saying it's really that it comes down to that, and under the Bowman case, and either is or it isn't, and you don't have to, it doesn't take 20 pages to say that. Is that the gist of the argument?
That's pretty much it. I mean, okay. As Mr. Eisenberg and I both commented, that these are about the shortest briefs we've ever written in a submission before this court, and I just don't think there's, unless this court really wants to get involved in relitigating and de novo issues on every arbitration case, I think the standard of the manifest disregard and the little test that is set forth in the Bowman case must be applied. And this is just not a case where there's a demonstration in the record that somehow the arbitrator or somehow that there was a compelling an issue of law in Nevada that compelled a different result, and then that number two, she somehow disregarded that. She made the wrong choice of law, and the record just does not support that. As I noted, this is a contract and an investment that was put together in California between California residents. The California residents specifically state in their operating agreement, the controlling agreement between the parties, which provides for the arbitration, that California law will apply. And the arbitrator made a specific factual finding that that was the intent of the parties, and that's what she applied. And if you look at the authority that she cited, the Cochran case, it basically addresses the same kind of problem. And it says it dealt with Arizona and California. And in that case, it's an old case, but it makes the comment that these type of laws, like in Nevada, where you say the broker must be licensed to receive a commission, that is fairly fact-specific, and it is designed to protect the parties to the transaction from specious or false claims for commission. It is not, and they say it specifically, is not designed to prohibit a resident of another state from collecting residents of the same state commissions that were in fact earned. And that's pretty much exactly what you find happened in this case. The sale documents specifically recognize that Mr. Mann is a licensed broker, that he is the broker representing the buyers, and that Mr. Dakar spent 2 hours going over all of those documents. And then he ultimately in 2004, 5 years after the close of escrow, sues Mr. Mann saying, "I'm shocked and amazed that you got a commission out of this deal." And the arbitrator, just after looking at all the documents associated with the transaction, just says that's not true. She makes a specific factual finding that just flat didn't occur.
One last question. You may or may not know the answer to that, but was there any evidence presented at the arbitration as to why the parties formed a Nevada limited liability company as opposed to a California limited liability company?
I just do not know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Justice Sada? Justice Gibbons? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Eisenberg, you have 2 minutes and 43 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start by answering Justice Gibbons' question about why the arbitrator decided to apply California law. There was a provision in the operating agreement that referred to California law, but we submit that there's a big difference between a choice of law provision, which would apply to everything in the agreement, and the provision in this case, which was clearly tied to the arbitration. There were 4 pages under the main heading of arbitration, 4 pages with multiple paragraphs, subparagraphs, and sub-subparagraphs. Buried within the arbitration provision was a provision indicating that if there are disputes arising out of matters in the arbitration of disputes provision, it will be decided by a neutral arbitration as provided by California law. And in the same paragraph, later on, a sentence or two later, it refers to arbitration under authority of the California Code of Civil Procedure. We think it's obvious that this provision referring to California law was only dealt with the procedures relating to arbitration. There's no way that this could be read so broadly to be construed as a choice of law provision in that context, particularly in light of the purchase agreement, which itself said that Nevada law would apply. Now, counsel argues here that there's some kind of a merger between the two agreements. To the best of my recollection, this is the first time we're hearing that argument, that there was some kind of a merger, and I haven't researched that issue or looked into it. This is the first time we're hearing it. There was no merger here. The purchase agreement was separate, and the commission was paid pursuant to the purchase agreement. I'd also like to address counsel's point that the arbitrator made a finding that Mr. Takkar was aware of the commissions. The arbitrator didn't make that finding. What the arbitrator found was that the contract disclosed that Mr. Mann was a real estate agent, which is true, it did. But that contract did not disclose that he would be getting a commission, and I don't believe the arbitrator actually made that finding. And then, Your Honor, you also asked about the record and whether there was a transcript. It wasn't reported, and unfortunately, there is no transcript to that. I would just like to conclude by saying that we believe this record does support finding of manifest disregard under this court's standards, and this matter should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
No.
Thanks to both counsel for their enlightened argument in this matter, and Ms. Cummings, this matter will stand submitted, and we'll be in recess.